Clinton gets a convention bump while Ryan finally gets backed by Trump. A rocky week for the GOP on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. If Donald Trump is defeated this year, will he pull Republican senators down with him?
Too hard to say. Too many races are just too close. You know, it is clear that far more races on the Republican side are competitive than the Democratic side.
And if the Democratic ticket wins in November, who will replace Tim Kaine in the Senate?
Among the three congresspeople right now, Jerry Connolly, Don Beyer, Bobby Scott, while they're all, I believe, pretty well qualified to be the senator, you'd have to say that Scott, if he wants it, sort of stands alone in terms of stature and experience.
Plus, a new biography of Robert Kennedy details both the bad Bobby and the good Bobby. Does he compare with anyone running this year?
I think what he captured was precisely what today's candidates are trying hard for and have yet to capture, which was a sense of believability and authenticity. And if Bobby Kennedy was nothing else by the end, he was authentic.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 140 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Another week has gone by, and if you're a Republican, another week of wasted opportunities for Donald Trump. His thumbing his nose at Paul Ryan, John McCain, and Kelly Ayotte drove the party establishment nuts. Even a crying baby became a controversy.
Ripped us absolutely to shreds. Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here.
But taking pot shots at his fellow Republicans was not going well with the Republican Party. And while the GOP nominee is not known for acknowledging a mistake, Trump seemed to reverse course by the end of last week. At a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Trump said this, reading from a piece of paper.
In our shared mission to make America great again, I support and endorse our Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. And while I'm at it, I hold in the highest esteem Senator John McCain for his service to our country in uniform and in public office, and I fully support and endorse his reelection. Very important. We'll work together. I also fully support and endorse Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, a state I truly love, primarily because that was my first victory, but I love New Hampshire.
As it turned out, Ryan, who has never tried to hide his displeasure with Trump despite his endorsement, won handily in Tuesday's primary, even though his opponent tried to make it a referendum on Donald Trump.
I believe here in Wisconsin we have a unified Republican Party. We have a unified Republican Party because we tell people who we are, what we believe, what our principles are, and what we'll do if we get elected. And then, like we had happen here in Wisconsin, we did it.
But other Republicans are furious with their undisciplined presidential nominee. Congressman Richard Hanna of upstate New York says not only can he not support Trump, he will vote for Hillary Clinton. Congressman Scott Ridgel of Virginia announced he will vote for Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party candidate. Now, it's important to point out that both Hanna and Ridgel are retiring this year. But there are other Republicans who are set to be seriously mulling a break from Trump as well. Meanwhile, the unity problems that were on display at the Democratic convention seem to have faded from view. No Democratic member of Congress is hinting about voting third party, let alone Trump. And yes, we still have 3 months to go. But a new ABC News Washington Post poll has Clinton ahead, 50-42. And separate polls in the battleground states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and New Hampshire show Clinton with the momentum, up 9 in Michigan, 11 in Pennsylvania, and 17 in New Hampshire. These numbers got the attention of a lot of political types this week. But Jeff Greenfield, the veteran political journalist, is nonplussed about polls at this stage of the campaign. I spoke with him at the convention in Philadelphia.
You know, I've said over and over again to people that polls are the crack cocaine of political junkies. That's why we call them junkies. People go nuts. Their heads explode with these numbers. For me, let's see what happens around Labor Day. Because it is true, almost without exception in modern times, that who's ever ahead by Labor Day tends to wins the election. So you want to let this convention play out. And the impatience factor of journalists, I've often said it reminds me of, you're pulling out of the driveway on a way to vacation and your kids start screaming, "Are we there yet?" And it starts like 2 years before the damn nomination. And what it is about this process that makes patience completely disappear, yes, in a 24-hour news cycle, you always got to feed the beast. But, try the decaf is my motto for political journalists at this time because you don't know.
If Jeff Greenfield is right, that we shouldn't really pay attention to polls until Labor Day, then it's time for this week's trivia question. Who is the last presidential candidate who led in the polls on Labor Day, but went on to lose the election in November? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. For all the focus on the race for president, there seems to be just as much urgency in the battle for control of the Senate. Should Hillary Clinton win the White House, Democrats will need a net gain of 4 seats to get a majority, 5 if Trump wins. But right now, there is no shortage of Republican incumbents who are running scared, and especially scared that Trump could hurt their chances in November. Greg Giroux is a political reporter for Bloomberg and is watching the numbers like the rest of us. Greg, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thank you for the invitation, Ken.
Well, I keep hearing a lot of members of Congress, a lot of Republican incumbents are running scared. Do you think rightly so?
Yeah. I think they have to be concerned about the political environment, especially in the Senate, because the ratio of Senate seats up for grabs is skewed very heavily against the Republicans. And so even if someone other than Donald Trump were not leading the ticket, it would still have been a tough election year for Republicans to defend their Senate majority. But with Hillary Clinton seeming to open up a bit of a lead on Donald Trump and with a greater straight ticket voting, meaning more people voting the same party for president as they do for the Senate, that just exacerbates the challenge for Senate Republicans.
And when you have 34 seats at stake, 24 of which are held by Republicans, obviously they have much more to lose.
That's right. And of those 24 seats where Republicans are defending Senate seats, 7 of them are in states that President Obama won in the 2012 election. And that ratio, 24 to 10, is the most partisan lopsided ratio since 1980 when Democrats lost the Senate majority in the Reagan landslide year, and it was an exact partisan mirror image of the ratio we have today, 24 seats Democrats were defending then versus 10 for Republicans.
Well, before we go through the list of vulnerable Republicans, let's dispose of the Democrats first because I think there's less to talk about. They have 10 seats. I don't see any one of them vulnerable other than the open seat in Nevada where Harry Reid is living.
Right. So President Obama won all 10 states where Democrats are defending Senate seats, and only 2 of those states was his margin less than 10 points. One of them was in Nevada, as you mentioned. The other one was in Colorado, where Republicans held out some early hope of making a competitive race against Senator Michael Bennet, but it doesn't look that way. The only Democratic-held seat is the one in Nevada, Harry Reid's seat.
Let's go through the list of vulnerable Republicans. My list, I'm sure yours and mine are probably the same, and they're probably it's longer than the Republicans would like. Let's start with Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent in New Hampshire.
Ayotte, the former state attorney general, was, like the Republicans who are defending their seats this year, had a very favorable political environment in 2010. It was a really good year to be a Republican in New Hampshire in 2010, and she won easily. This year, running in a state that Obama won by about 6 points in 2012, she faces a much stronger opponent in Democrat Maggie Hassan, who is finishing up her second two-year term as the state's chief executive.
You know, when you think of 2014, which was a big year for the Republicans nationwide, it was not a big year for the Republicans in New Hampshire when, Senator Shaheen was reelected, the governor was reelected. So you just wonder if maybe New Hampshire may be more Democratic-leaning than once was thought.
Yes, New Hampshire is certainly better for the Democrats generally the last decade or so than it was throughout the 1980s and up until about the early 1990s when Bill Clinton carried the state in 1992. It was a pretty strongly Republican state throughout the 1980s. But as a result of national and local political factors, some demographic shifts, the Democrats have made some gains in New Hampshire recently. And in the 2012 election, it actually voted slightly more Democratic than the nation did for Obama in 2012.
Indiana is a state that I didn't have on my list a short time ago, but things have changed pretty quickly in Indiana.
That's right. This should have been a pretty easy hold for the Republicans. You had Congressman Todd Young, a three-term member from southern Indiana, as a strong favorite against retiring Senator Dan Coats. The original Democratic nominee, Barron Hill, a former congressman, would have been a distinct underdog against Todd Young. But just a few weeks ago, the race was upended with the unexpected entry of Evan Bayh, Indiana's former governor and senator. Bayh, after he left, retired from the Senate in 2010 and was succeeded by Coates, held on to a huge campaign treasury that is now greater than $9 million. He didn't give it to charity or to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee to the annoyance of some party activists, but it turns out that big campaign treasury will be a major asset for Bayh as he begins the race with a lot of residual name recognition. He has a long political service career in Indiana, but he hasn't been on the ballot in 12 years, and he hasn't faced a Republican like Congressman Young before. So I'm expecting a highly competitive race here as well.
I'm assuming you may agree with this. I think the two most vulnerable Republican incumbents are Ron Johnson in Wisconsin and Mark Kirk of Illinois.
That's correct. I think that's almost certainly true in no small part because those two states of the seven where Republicans are defending Senate seats in states that Obama won, those are the two strongest pro-Obama states in 2012. Illinois, the president's home state, Obama won that state by 17 points. Wisconsin, Obama won by 7. And in Illinois, Kirk won his seat by a very bare margin in 2010, a very good Republican year. And he's facing a better Democratic opponent in a higher turnout year that's going to be more Democratic, certainly, than 2010 was.
And one difference also is that unlike Ron Johnson, who has embraced Donald Trump, Mark Kirk says he will not vote for Trump. And I assume that will alienate Trump supporters and conservatives in Illinois.
Yeah, I mean, that's one approach that a lot of these Republican incumbents are taking with Trump. You look at the incumbents who are in the tough races and how they're approaching it, sort of runs the gamut. Kirk and Johnson, as you mentioned, are very different. Kirk has denounced Trump pretty strongly. And as you mentioned, there is some political risk that attached to that and that you don't want to antagonize or depress part of your base, because even if Kirk doesn't like Trump, he still wants all of the Trump backers to vote for him down ballot. But his play is for, independent voters and perhaps try and peel off some Democrats.
Perhaps one of the most visible Republicans up for re-election this year is John McCain. We know the rocky relationship he's had with Donald Trump. Donald Trump once belittling his status as a prisoner of war during Vietnam. Now, of course, he turned around last week. But still, I mean, with a larger segment of Latinos voting in Arizona, John McCain must be running scared.
Yeah, I think he said that this would be his toughest re-election of his career. Now, he's won most of them pretty easily, but in this case, he must first face down a primary challenge on August the 30th from Kelly Ward, a former state senator. I'm not sure there's going to be a significant anti-McCain vote in the primary. I think that's clear. Whether it's large enough to put Kelly Ward over the top in the primary, I'm not so sure about that. But waiting to oppose McCain in a general election if he wins his primary is Ann Kirkpatrick, who is a Democrat with some moderate leanings who represents a very politically competitive district in Arizona.
If Evan Bayh came into Indiana race and helping the Democrats' chances there, I guess I assume that Marco Rubio just changing his mind and deciding to run for re-election in Florida helps the Republican Party in that state?
It certainly does. I think before Rubio announced in late June that he would reverse his earlier decision to eschew re-election, I think you probably could have ranked Florida as the third most likely state to shift from Republican to Democrat after Illinois and Wisconsin. On the Democratic side, it looks like two-term Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy is putting some distance between himself and the more liberal Congressman Alan Grayson.
And more controversial Alan Grayson.
Oh, certainly. Certainly that's one reason why the White House rallied early behind Murphy. President Obama, Vice President Biden have appeared in TV ads and campaigned for Murphy, who has a history, who's won two elections, albeit against weak Republican opponents in a mildly Republican-leaning district in southeastern Florida. But, you know, Rubio deciding for run for re-election, it certainly was good news for the Republicans when he made that decision.
The other Republicans on my list, I have Rob Portman in Ohio, who's running against former Governor Ted Strickland. I have Roy Blunt, whose numbers are pretty close in Missouri. I have Richard Burr in North Carolina, looks interesting, given the controversy over HB2, the bathroom gender bill, which could very well topple the Republican governor there.
That's right. North Carolina is a really interesting state politically. Voted for Obama in 2008, was very close for Romney in 2012, and probably will be among the presidential battlegrounds in this election. Richard Burr has never run for re-election in a presidential election year. He was first elected to the Senate in 2004 when North Carolina was more Republican than it is today. North Carolina is one of those states that it may not be quite in the same league of competitiveness as, say, in Indiana or Illinois or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, but it's certainly one to watch.
Well, you mentioned Pennsylvania, and there's a reason you'll find out later why I'm ending with Pennsylvania, but Pat Toomey is the Republican incumbent seeking re-election, and the latest polls, I know this is August, not October or November, but the latest polls have Hillary Clinton way up in Pennsylvania. I just wonder how that would affect Toomey's re-election chances.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something he has to be mindful of because we're just seeing a rise in straight ticket voting. And, you know, here's an interesting stat for you. We presently have 84 of the 100 senators are of the same party as the presidential candidate who won their state in 2012. That is the highest such number since before the 1950s, according to data from political scientist Gary C. Jacobson. So we're seeing this increase in party line voting. And the challenge for Republican incumbents like Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania is to run enough ahead of Trump to win re-election. I think a template for Toomey is the 2000 re-election of Rick Santorum. When he was elected to a second term in a presidential election year, Al Gore carried the state by a few points, and Santorum beat Democrat Congressman Ron Klink by a few points.
Well, as I just said, you'll soon see why we're ending our conversation with the Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania. But anyway, Greg Giroux is a political reporter for Bloomberg. His Twitter feed is GREGGIROUX. Greg, thanks so much. And before you go, prediction, we have 3 months to go. Who wins control of the Senate in November?
Oh, it's too hard to say.
Greg.
Too hard to say. Too many races are just too close. You know, it is clear that far more races on the Republican side are competitive than the Democratic side. I mean, I think today you'd have to give the Democrats greater than a 50% chance of winning the Senate, though. So, today it's probably more likely than not, but it's certainly not a sure thing. Just too many races are in play.
We'll definitely have you back as we get closer to November. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sock it to me, baby.
McCain, the junior senator from Virginia, is Hillary Clinton's running mate. It was made official at the Democratic convention last month in Philadelphia.
Today, for my wife, Ann, and every strong woman in this country, for Nat, Woody, and Anella, and every young person starting out in life to make their own dreams real, for every man and woman serving our country in the military, at home or abroad, for every working family working hard to get ahead and stay ahead, for my parents and in-laws, and every senior citizen who hopes for a dignified retirement with health care and research to end diseases like Alzheimer's, for every American who wants our country to be a beloved community where people aren't demeaned because of who they are, but rather respected for their contributions to this nation, and for all of us who know that the brightest future for our country is the one that we build together, and for my friend Hillary Clinton, I humbly accept my party's nomination to be Vice President of the United States.
And yes, that was all one sentence. If the Clinton-Kane ticket wins in November, the decision to replace Kane in the Senate will be made by Virginia's Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe. With many names being put forward as possible successors, we're turning to Bob Holdsworth to help sort it all out. Bob is one of the best political analysts in the Old Dominion. He's a managing principal of Decide Smart. Before that, he was the founding director of the Center for Public Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University. Bob Holdsworth, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken.
Bob, before we go on, tell me, what is Decide Smart?
Decide Smart's a consulting firm in which we work with a lot of local governments in which we try to help them operate more effectively. It's a nonpartisan firm. We don't get involved in any kind of political consulting, or we don't really work with candidates at all.
You know Virginia politics and their politicians probably better than anyone. Were you surprised at the Tim Kaine pick?
I really wasn't surprised at the Tim Kaine pick, because we have to remember that Tim Kaine probably came in second to Joe Biden in 2008 when Barack Obama was first elected. And at that time, the major holdup, or you might say the major deficiency that Tim Kaine had, was that he had no foreign policy experience. But after he was elected to the Senate, he served on some important foreign policy and international relations committees in the Senate, and that deficiency had been wiped out. And given the fact that Virginia is often seen as a battleground state, that just had to be added impetus. But I think Tim Kaine in many ways has the perfect resume for a vice presidential candidate.
And one more thing in his favor, there's a Democratic governor who will name his replacement.
Right. As you know, that there was some thought about, you know, Sherrod Brown or Elizabeth Warren. And in a number of instances, what we saw was that there was some real reservation, or Cory Booker on the Clinton team's part, that if they had to potentially lose a Senate seat because a Republican would be nominating the successor, that wouldn't be something they wanted.
Once Tim Kaine was named and we were looking at possible successors, I think the name that was most often bandied about was the governor himself, Terry McAuliffe. Now, that means he'd have to resign as governor and then have his lieutenant governor appoint him to the Senate. That would be a tough sell to voters. Usually that's the case, right?
I think that would be a tough sell. McAuliffe himself has said almost categorically, or as categorically as you could find a politician making a statement, that he really has no interest in the Senate. Actually, I think it might be more interesting to ask if whether McAuliffe would have an interest in being appointed to a Clinton cabinet position. But I really don't see him as seeking the Senate seat or wanting to have resign in order to be appointed that way. That my sense is that I would take him at face value here when he says he really doesn't want that Senate seat.
Now, if Terry McAuliffe picks somebody from the House, it would obviously, same argument against Sherrod Brown in Ohio, it would have to be someone in a safe Democratic seat, a seat that the party wouldn't be nervous about losing, right?
Yeah, at the moment, there are three Democrats in out of the 11-member congressional delegation. I think we'll gain a fourth Democrat in Virginia because of a redistricting case that went through the courts. And all of those Democrats are in very safe seats at the moment. So the question is, of those congresspeople, who would be the leader? And it would seem to me that the leading candidate would really be Congressman Bobby Scott. Scott was the first African-American elected to Congress in Virginia since Reconstruction. He has taken some stances on issues that ultimately were confirmed, even though he was fairly lonely at the beginning. He was against the Iraq War. He's a person who was early on to the whole issue of criminal justice reform. And it seems among the three congresspeople right now, Jerry Connolly, Don Beyer, Bobby Scott, while they're all, I believe, pretty well qualified to be the senator, you'd have to say that Scott, if he wants it, sort of stands alone in terms of stature and experience.
And Bobby Scott is the one who nominated Tim Kaine at the convention.
Exactly. And you know, one of the other things about Scott is that he has run because his district has changed over time in two of the major metropolitan areas of Virginia. He's run both in Hampton Roads and in Richmond metropolitan area. He's never run in Northern Virginia. But at the same time, because he is certainly as progressive, if not more progressive than most political figures in Virginia, he'd probably be pretty popular in Northern Virginia.
And Virginia is also, we've also seen in Virginia that the voters will and can vote for an African-American at the top of the ticket, as we saw with Doug Wilder for lieutenant governor and then governor.
Right. Virginia, in fact, was the first state in the country to elect an African-American as governor, something that has not been done very frequently since that time. We've seen that with Deval Patrick, but I don't think that would really be an issue with Bobby Scott at all. At one time, people might have thought that his positions were too liberal for Virginia. But I think over the years, Virginia's own politics has evolved. And Scott, in an election in an off year, could probably mobilize the Democratic base perhaps better than any other elected official that we have now.
Governor McAuliffe has not tipped his hand about whom he possibly would appoint for the Senate. But do you get a sense there are any women on a prospective list?
I think there could be. I think the person that has been mentioned most, but I think might be a little bit of a reach, would be Tim Kaine's spouse, Ann Holton, who, again, if that was possible to have a vice president's spouse running for the Senate seat, she'd be a very formidable candidate, too. Extremely bright, extremely sharp. She's been Secretary of Education. She's been a judge, very well known throughout the state, very well liked. And then, you know, there are a couple of folks in the state legislature that you could go to, Jennifer McClellan, probably late 30s, mid-30s, Democrat in the House of Delegates who is very well respected, and somebody maybe like Janet Howell of Northern Virginia. But again, it would seem to me that if those people, with the exception of Ann Holton, were selected to sort of catapult over Bobby Scott, that would be seen as a snub.
The Democrats need only 4 Senate seats this year to take control. So it's possible, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in November, but it's very possible that whoever wins the 2017 Virginia Senate race, it could be critical to which party controls the Senate.
Oh, absolutely. Can you imagine if there's one Senate race up for grabs in 2017 and that race has the potential of changing control of the U.S. Senate? It would be like a race you've never seen before in America, almost. You would see every political action committee, the national parties. You could see a $50 million race. And I think when you think about who might get excited about running on the Republican side, you're beginning to see this. You're beginning to see David Bratt, the person who knocked off Eric Cantor, say that he might be interested if, you know, Clinton is elected president and Kaine has to give up the seat. I'm thinking that you may see somebody like Carly Fiorina, who happens to live in Virginia, get into this race. So there's even speculation that maybe, you know, Ed Gillespie, who said he's running for governor, could back off that and perhaps run for Senate. I'm not sure that would happen. But my sense is that if you wind up with a 51-49 or a 50-50 Senate after the November elections, this race would be the most watched race and the most expensive Senate race that we've ever seen in Virginia, and clearly would have tremendous national implications.
Well, given the importance of the 2017 Senate race, if Kaine is elected vice president, then do you think it's just Terry McAuliffe's choice? Or I assume there'd be tremendous input from the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee.
Oh, I think you'll get input from the Clinton campaign, the Democratic National Committee, but I think we have to see that McAuliffe, Kaine, and Clinton are kind of pretty close right now, so they're probably thinking through this in similar ways. At the same time, you've seen the Black Legislative Caucus, the Black Caucus at the congressional level, say they're supporting Bobby Scott already. I think you're going to likely see some other prominent Virginians come out and suggest who they're going to support as well. So I'm just not sure that this is going to be something directed at the national level. But I think that what you're also going to see is a lot of people in Virginia come out with their candidate as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, as crucial as Virginia is as a key battleground state in 2016, my goodness, 2017 is going to be amazing.
Exactly. The one knock that some people have had on Congressman Scott is that he doesn't raise a ton of money, never really has had to. But my sense is that in 2017, the individual candidate will have to do very little fundraising, given the fact that I think this is going to be a race that could have tremendous national implications. The national parties and all of the PACs associated with both parties are likely to ensure that whoever the candidate is on either side is going to be extraordinarily well-funded.
Bob Holdsworth is a leading expert on Virginia politics. Bob, thanks so much for being on the show.
Great to be with you again, Ken.
Did you ever have to make up your mind and pick up the one and leave the other behind? It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind? Did you ever have to finally decide and say yes to one and let the other one ride? There's so many changes and tears you must hide. Did you ever have to finally decide?
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last presidential candidate who had the lead in delegates going into the convention but failed to win his or her party's nomination? The answer, Estes Kefauver in 1952. The Tennessee senator had the most delegates going into that year's Democratic convention in Chicago, but lost the nomination to Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson on the third ballot. The randomly selected winner is Jason Sills of Salt Lake City, Utah. Jason wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutton puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. I've been a political junkie for quite some time. I was a political junkie as a senior in high school, although it was past my bedtime when these words were said.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
That was New York Senator Robert F. Kennedy declaring victory at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles following the crucial 1968 Democratic primary for president in California. Within minutes, Kennedy was shot, the victim of an assassin's bullets. He lingered for a day, and it was his top press aide, Frank Mankiewicz, who gave us the terrible news at Good Samaritan Hospital.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968. With Senator Kennedy, at the time of his death, were his wife, Ethel, his sisters, Mrs. Stephen Smith, Mrs. Patricia Lawford, brother-in-law, Mr. Stephen Smith, her sister-in-law, Mrs. John F. Kennedy. He was 42 years old.
Politics means a lot of different things to different people. For me, I spend much time thinking about the what-ifs. And one of my most significant what-ifs of my political memory has always been, what if Bobby Kennedy lived? What if he didn't walk through the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel and fall victim to Sirhan's bullets? How different would our country have been? The things he fought for, peace in Vietnam, social justice, an end to poverty, I ask these questions not as a Kennedy supporter or an opponent, just as someone who wonders, what if? Larry Tye has written an outstanding book, by far the best biography of RFK I have ever read. It's Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's Kennedy, warts and all, the bad Bobby, the good Bobby, the ruthless Bobby, the compassionate Bobby. It's a superb read. Larry Tye, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be on with you, Ken.
You know, as I've said, there have been biographies of Bobby Kennedy that portray him as a saint. Some have seen him as a sinner. This one seems to tell us the complete story.
Yes. So I think that he started out as an extraordinarily different figure than he ended up as. He started out as a Joe McCarthy cold warrior, and he ended up as a liberal icon. And his transformation was, in fact, a lens into how America was changing in, I think, the best ways, from the 1950s era of Eisenhower to the tumult of the 1960s.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people, when they describe Bobby Kennedy, they say, well, here's the bad Bobby, here's the good Bobby. And they forget the fact that he was going through, as you just said, a transformation like the country was going through. And he started out working for Joe McCarthy. He was a cold warrior. I think when he was, even when Jack Kennedy was running for president in 1960, both he and Bobby were distrusted, I guess, by some liberals. They saw him as a cold warrior.
That's true. And I think that what Bobby does, Ken, you and I have been around a long time watching politicians. And these days, anybody who changes, we label as a flip-flopper and dismiss them. And I think what Bobby Kennedy says, not only that you can change and grow, but it gives faith in this basic American principle of redemption. And Bobby Kennedy really did learn as he went. And I think he got better and better to the point where when he died that night that you were just describing after his victory speech at the Ambassador Hotel, he was on the verge of being either the tough liberal or the tender conservative that lots of us have been waiting for 50 years.
You know, I wonder what it is about Bobby Kennedy that affects me the way it does, and it certainly does. He was only in the Senate for 3.5 years. He wasn't an institutionalist like his brother Teddy was. He didn't, you know, pass a lot of legislation. I wonder if it's that he had this potential, that he had so much he had to offer, that he wanted to offer, and it was taken away from him.
So I think it's that. It's partly, if you look at the picture on the cover of my book, that shows Bobby Kennedy at age 42 and looking forever young. And I think partly what we all regret is that he seemed like this guy with extraordinary potential who never got a chance to play that out. His brother Jack got to be president for 3 years, and we at least had a feel for what he could offer. His brother Ted spent 50 years in the Senate. Bobby was the one who arguably was better prepared for national leadership than any of the Kennedys had ever been. He had not just been attorney general. He had run his brother's hard-nosed campaign for the presidency. He had been a congressional staffer. He had worked for 3 years in the Senate, getting an extraordinary amount done for that short tenure he was there. And it seemed like he knew how to exercise the levers of power. And unlike his brother Jack, he was so passionate and so impatient that I think from day one he would have at least tried to get major things done and might have succeeded.
I've always been fascinated by Bobby's relationship with Lyndon Johnson. I mean, he was opposed to Johnson's pick as vice president in 1960. He kind of like mocked Lyndon Johnson during those vice presidential years. And of course, we know what the relationship was like after Dallas. So that was a very complicated and fascinating relationship.
It was. So in his life, Bobby had four people that he truly detested. And I think he had pretty good judgment on the first three. They were Joe McCarthy's young aide, and as we find out now, Donald Trump's tutor, Roy Cohn. They were FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who had outmaneuvered attorneys general and presidents for decades. And they were Jimmy Hoffa, the controversial and, according to Bobby Kennedy, corrupt leader of the largest union in the country, the Teamsters. Those three were understandable. To me, it was kind of tragic that the fourth enemy, and maybe the one he was most vitriolic about, was LBJ. And I think they just came from different enough worlds. Bobby Kennedy came from the world of Harvard and privilege. Lyndon Johnson came from the world of East Texas and resenting privilege, and they were almost destined to dislike one another. And yet, had they ever collaborated, they both believed passionately in ending poverty, they both believed in racial justice, and as a team, they could have been extraordinary, and they might have even gotten us out of Vietnam earlier if LBJ hadn't detested Bobby Kennedy so much that every time Bobby called for a halt in the bombing, LBJ seemed to double his efforts in Vietnam.
Yeah, I think every time I think of Bobby, and I never met him, but I always think that had I met him, I would have loved to have known him during those years from 63 to 68. One of the most fascinating things to me is that complicated thought processes that Kennedy went through, whether to run for president or not. I'm going to play a little piece of tape right now when basically he's saying, I think it's early in 68 when he says, I'm not running for president, I'm supporting Lyndon Johnson.
I have, I'm going to remain on as a United States Senator representing the state of New York, and I'm going to support the Democratic ticket in 1968 of President Johnson, Hubert Humphrey.
Larry, do you hear those boos at the end of that?
I hear those boos, and I hear in his voice, and maybe I'm reading it into his voice, the indecision. I think he was choking on those words. I think he always wanted to run against LBJ. He wanted to take him on the war. He wanted to push him to go harder and faster on both civil rights and anti-poverty programs. And yet Bobby Kennedy grew up with three totems, and those were things he believed in passionately. One was Catholicism. A second was the primacy of the Kennedy family. And the third, and maybe the most important, was that you don't mess around with fellow Democrats, and you certainly don't take on not only your brother's vice president, but the sitting president. And so he tortured himself, and he ended up having arguably the most ham-handed entry into a presidential race that I've seen in my lifetime, where he waited until just after Senator Eugene McCarthy, had beat LBJ in New Hampshire. When you added in the Republican vote...
Oh, okay. I would say he came close, certainly.
He came close with the Democratic votes. You add in the Republican votes, and he actually narrowly won. And at that moment, which was the moment that should have been the shining light for Eugene McCarthy, who had agreed to challenge LBJ when Bobby wouldn't, Bobby announced that he was coming in.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. My decision reflects no personal animosity or disrespect toward President Johnson.
Larry, it was personal, wasn't it?
It was personal. It precisely reflected the animosity. He said it didn't. And it was also an echo of a speech 8 years before given in the exact same Senate caucus room that his brother Jack had given and that Bobby, as his campaign manager, had orchestrated when JFK announced for the presidency in 1960.
In your book, you talk about the early Bobby Kennedy, and maybe when Jack Kennedy is trying to be cozy with some of the Southern governors, the John Pattersons, the George Wallaces, people like that. And some people basically questioned Bobby's commitment to civil rights in the early days, yes?
They did question it, and they rightfully questioned it. It wasn't so much that he wasn't committed. It was that he was naive about what was really going on with civil rights. And he was telling people like Martin Luther King Jr. and like the Freedom Riders who were trying to integrate interstate transportation, he was telling them, slow down. Don't embarrass President Kennedy, who is now trying to have a summit with Nikita Khrushchev. And in the eyes of the world, it won't look good if we've got this incredibly antagonistic racial situation. And the idea of telling civil rights leaders who had been going slow forever that they ought to slow down suggested in the early days that he didn't get it. He didn't get it when he waited too long to insert federal troops in Anniston, Alabama, in Birmingham, in Montgomery, and most notably at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. And people got hurt because of that. The good news is that Bobby Kennedy learned from every one of those mistakes. And by the end, when he stood up in the schoolhouse door with Governor George Wallace of Alabama, who was trying to keep the University of Alabama from being integrated, Bobby stood up to him, he won the day there, and he showed by the end of his tenure that he justified the faith that a young Martin Luther King had told his aides to have in this Bobby Kennedy. Martin Luther King in the bad days said, there's some good there in Bobby Kennedy, and we're gonna find that good, and we're going to tap it. And he was right.
And when I think of one of the most monumental speeches of his career, maybe one of the greatest speeches in 20th century political history, I think of Kennedy's speech in Indianapolis before a largely black crowd in April of 1968.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love.
You know, I know we're not supposed to play out long sound bites in this day of a short attention span theater, but I played a lot of that because I think that just said a lot about Bobby Kennedy in that speech in Indianapolis.
That speech, he is contesting his first primary in 1968 in the state of Indiana. He arrives in Indianapolis to hear that Martin Luther King has been shot and killed. The mayor of Indianapolis, who went on to become a powerful U.S. senator named Richard Lugar, says, Bobby, you will not go into your rally tonight in the inner city. You could get hurt. People there could get hurt. Bobby says, thanks for the advice, and he takes off to the inner city. He gets there, and he throws away his prepared remarks. He jumps up to the back of a flatbed truck, and he delivers those extraordinary words that you just played. It is the first time that he's ever talked publicly about how he felt about his brother's death. It was just 5 minutes, but it was pitch perfect. And that night, in more than 100 cities across America, there were race riots. One of the only cities in the entire country with a substantial African-American population that didn't riot was Indianapolis, and I think that was because of Bobby Kennedy. And it was showing that night that the faith that Martin Luther King had put in him was justified. It was making clear that from that night until the end of the campaign and the end of Bobby's life, he was the singly most trusted white man in black America. And maybe most importantly for us today, his remarks there that night, I think, are precisely the tone that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and maybe Donald Trump have been trying to or should be trying to strike today, and nobody has quite found those words. Barack Obama came the closest in his 45-minute remarks in Dallas, but Bobby said it in 5 minutes, and people listened.
I'm listening to every word you're saying, and I'm jumping back and forth between 2016 and 1968. Look, 68 was a horrific year, and there was so much disillusionment in 2016. But, you know, I keep hearing about the good Hillary Clinton, the bad Hillary Clinton, you know, the smart Donald Trump, the bad Donald Trump. Do you see anything? Do you see any Bobby Kennedy in Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Well, so I got to show my stripes. I see very little Bobby Kennedy in Donald Trump, and I see actually exactly the opposite of what Bobby was trying to do in 68. He was trying to construct a coalition of the angry white Donald Trump supporters, and those are the kinds of blue-collar working-class Democrats that were with Bobby at the beginning when he was a Joe McCarthy guy. But instead of trying to cut them off from the rest of America, he was trying to build bridges between them and the natural Hillary coalition of liberals and African-Americans and Hispanics. And he was trying to take, I think, and say America really could be united in something other than just rhetoric. And what that meant, and the only way he could do that, was he would go into black America and white America, and he would give exactly the same speeches, talking about the need for public safety, but the need for racial reconciliation. And it could have been that he turned off everybody with those speeches, but I think what he captured was precisely what today's candidates are trying hard for and have yet to capture, which was a sense of believability and authenticity. And if Bobby Kennedy was nothing else by the end, he was authentic. He was clear on what he believed in. He said, I'm running for president for two very simple reasons, which are to end the war and to end poverty in America. And those are two pretty good reasons 50 years later. And in terms of the racial issues, since nobody can prove me wrong with the what-ifs, I'd like to think that had he been president and had he, rather than Richard Nixon, been the one to try to bridge the racial gulf 50 years ago, we might not have such a gulf remaining 50 years later.
Larry Tye is a former reporter for the Boston Globe who has written an outstanding book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's Bobby, warts and all, regardless if you loved Bobby or hated him, and there were many of those on both sides, this book paints the complete picture. Larry, it's great having you on the program, and congratulations on such a superb biography.
I love being on with you, Ken, and thank you.
Bobby, can you tell me where he's gone? I thought I saw him walking up over the hill, Abraham and Martin and John.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.